Hillary nodded energetically. "Well, you can't miss this one. He's a big bugger." "Don't worry, miss. I'm sure we can take care of a monk, no matter what his size."
"Oh, please, call me Hillary."
"Best to stick with miss, if you don't mind, miss." Protection officers are discouraged from getting too emotionally close to their principal. This was a cornerstone of the rules that had evolved over the years. Familiarity may not breed contempt, but it could cloud judgment in moments of crisis. Hillary gave a little shrug that said, "Please yourself."
"Where'll you be? I mean, you won't be in here around the clock, will you? Or will you?"
Battered though she was, Hillary was starting to face the threat with some humour. "Somewhere outside," Brian said. "Not quite lying across your door, but certainly within sight of it. We'll go and take a look round, then we'll let you know." They explored the corridor and finally decided that, for the time being, they would use an office that was only occupied on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons. A couple of big-wheel consultants held their clinics on C7 then, but neither of the great men otherwise used the little office. After a telephone call, a techie turned up at a plain van and installed a silent alarm on Hillary's door and a look-see mirror that allowed the POs to sit in comfort within the office and still keep an eye on the private ward next door. Among the many advantages of this low-tech kit was its cheapness when compared to CCTV. "Round the clock," Pete told her. "We'll be there round the clock."
"Should I get lonely in the night, will you come and chat me up?"
"Well," he began, looking dubious. He had reason to take care, for he was married, and not happily. He suspected his wife would be delighted to catch him out in some adulterous crime or misdemeanor of the heart, so she could sue him for divorce and custody of the three-piece suite and the kitchen utensils. Pete loved his wife, who was young and wore tight dresses. He loved her more than she loved him, hence the unhappy marriage. If you weighed them in the balance, she would be found wanting. Very careful with other women, Pete Brooks. Hillary stepped in quickly.
"Don't look so worried," she laughed. "Can't really see myself chasing you round the bed trying to get a bit of nookie."
She grinned and waved a hand toward her raised, tractioned leg. She felt much better now that a couple of big, hairy policemen were there to look after her.
"You got a gun?" she asked,
then remembered the old joke and giggled.
"Or are you just pleased to see me?"
More giggles, but not from the police. "Yes, we're armed, miss." Appleby nodded.
"Show it to me."
She gave him her pale and interesting grin.
"And the gun."
Pete Brooks gave a little chuckle. "Incorrigible, miss." He lifted the corner of his jacket to reveal a Glock 9mm and a waist holster on his hip. These days, Glocks are the weapon of choice for many law enforcement officers and their opposite numbers in the criminal and terrorist worlds.
"My, you have got a big one, officer."
Hillary was nothing if not obvious. They told her there was absolutely nothing to worry about, that they would be around all the time, that they were well trained, that the threat, if it came at all, would most likely come either late at night or at dawn. "The rest of the time we just remain alert," Appleby said. Hillary thought they were very comforting, even though they were careful to tell her they would only be in her life for a short spell. "We're not going on your Christmas card list for the rest of our days, miss," Appleby said, grinning. The threat did not come late at night or at dawn. It came shortly after 9 o'clock on the Sunday morning. Father Martin, OSJ, a.k.a. Biridi Diosolavik, also Corporal Bertie Day, a.k.a. Father John, OSJ, a.k.a. Father Sebastian, OSJ, was a nutcase. In fact, he was the worst kind of nutcase. He was a psychopath of the mad and bad persuasion. He was dangerous in that he was convinced deep down within him that Hillary Cook had those letters and parcels of cash on her, with her there in the hospital. He was determined to lay his hands on those letters, particularly the fat ones stuffed with cash. Nobody could stop him, because he was well over 6'3" tall, built like a standing stone, with hands like hams, and he was perfectly prepared to perform actions of great violence on Hillary Cook, or anyone who got in his way.
He came rolling along, looking as though he were doing God's work on a Sunday morning, heading straight for C7. His reasoning was that 9 o'clock was a time when everyone would be busy on the ward, that also it was a Sunday, which meant a new shift would have started a month on days, and so would be getting acclimatized. He would undoubtedly be above suspicion, because he was dressed in the habit worn by the Order of St. Jerome, a tailored cassock with a tippet and a broad belt from which hung the crucifix. On a cold morning like this, he also wore his cloak with its lion's head clasp. The cloak billowed out around him, making him look like a huge top, as he marched with purpose toward the ward. Pete Brooks had taken over from Brian Appleby at a little after 7:30. He sat back in his chair, drinking a cup of black coffee, and taking an occasional squint at the mirror and the alarm. He was relaxed, and did not think any threat was imminent. He was wrong, and the alarm went off at precisely 9:12:32. We know that because one of the features of that particular alarm is that it prints out a small slip showing the time and date whenever the alarm is activated. The light began to blink rapidly, and Pete Brooks's eyes flicked up to the mirror. He saw the long skirt of a cassock twitching and disappearing through the door of Hillary's room. Pete drew the Glock and was out of the chair, through the door, and at Hillary Cook's door before he could recite the first two lines of the nursery rhyme, Jack and Jill, or some such nonsense. Like many of the protection officers in the United Kingdom, Pete had never drawn his weapon at a threat, but he had done all the drills and had no problem with drawing it now. He stepped into the little room and saw this huge figure dressed as a monk, leaning over Hillary Cook, with one hand bunched, rock-hard, above her face. Pete also took into account Hillary's face, which was contorted with fear.
"Armed police officer," he shouted. "Stand away from the bed and place your hands on your head. Down on the floor."
The monk glanced up, did not like what he saw, growled like a trapped animal, and wrapped his hand around a chair which he lifted above his head, and hurled in the direction of Pete Brooks, who stepped out of the way.
"Down on the ground now," Brooks yelled. "Hands on your head, lie down now."
The monk growled again and pushed a hand inside his cassock, at which point Pete Brooks, without hesitation, shot him twice in the head. The double tap, just as he had been taught. This was the right thing to do to protect his principal, and he knew it when a little gunmetal blue revolver skittered from the dead monk's hand. The monk's head exploded in a mash of blood, mucus, bone, and matter. A cloud of fine blood hung in the air for a second as the now useless body dropped to the floor with a bone-cracked crunch, and the stench of an abattoir filled the air. Hillary Cook began to scream. It was to be a lead news story for the next 3 days. On that same Sunday morning, Ronnie Richardson and Tessa Murray took a cab out to Heathrow Airport. They carried briefcases, and Tessa wore a smart backpack done in Gucci leather, matching her briefcase. They also carried raincoats and wandered from terminal to terminal, taking a cup of coffee here and a snack there. They covered a lot of ground, and finally hired a silver Vauxhall Tigra from Hertz, which they took back to Piccadilly. They checked out of the Regent Palace and drove up past the Albert Hall and into the forecourt of the Royal Garden Hotel, which looks out on Kensington Gardens. They checked into the Royal Garden and were shown to a stylish and splendidly appointed suite. "This is the life." Tessa enjoyed staying in luxury hotels. "When I've done the Presidentsky and his lady, we can live in hotels for the rest of our lives, if that's really what you want." Ronnie reached over and kissed her, long and lingering, the way they both liked it. But in the back of his head, death lurked, a dreadful shadow. While they were doing all this in London, Charlie Gauntlet on the Scottish island was reading what appeared to be the final pages of Naomi's diary.